Welcome to Design for Voice. I'm your host, Jeremy Wilkin, and today we're going to be looking at different design approaches that you can take and how they might be applied into the process of building out voice experiences. And there may be some different tactics and tools that we'll discover along the way. Today, I'm joined by Braden Rehm and Michael Hood of VoiceFlow. Why don't we kick it off? Tell us a little bit more about yourselves and VoiceFlow.
Thanks for having us. So I'm Braden, the CEO of VoiceFlow.
Yeah, and I'm Mike. I lead product here, and we are building the creative suite for voice interfaces.
Excellent. So what we want to kind of start with today is talking about what are the different types of design techniques that already exist out there. Some of them come from traditional design and development, like scripting or flowcharts. But what other things are out there today that are kind of more standard, common design tactics that people are using when they're trying to build out their voice experiences?
Yeah. So I think generally, you know, scripting and flowcharts, those are kind of two extremely popular examples of, you know, where people start when they're looking to build a voice interface. And then on top of that, we have, you know, newer approaches. You know, if we look at the work Amazon is doing with situational designs and the storyboard approach. But I think, you know, at VoiceFlow, talking to users, talking to the UI professionals daily, you know, those really scripting, flowcharts, and storyboards kind of, you know, probably provide, you know, at least 90% of what people are doing today. Now, that might not be the future. That might not be, you know, what the, you know, creative community needs to build really great voice interfaces. But that's kind of the state of affairs.
All right. So let's talk a little about, we'll start with scripting for a moment. Let's define it real quick in case someone's not familiar with it, and then talk a little bit about what it's really good at.
Sure. So the easiest way to think about scripting is I open a Word document. I've heard of a few other softwares that people actually use that are more tailored, but we'll use Word. And then I'm essentially saying, you know, user says, system says, user says, system says. And I'm doing this for what I would call my happy paths. So I'm looking at, you can take a kind of a topic approach. So, you know, if I am PayPal and I'm building my voice interface, maybe I want to check my balance, I want to send money, you know, I want to, you know, contact customer support, who knows, there's a variety of things, but it's up to the designer to kind of figure out what are those key topics. And then scripting is really a great place to just think about, hey, you know, this is a potential flow that my conversation could take. And really what it's doing is it's putting you in the right mental model to kind of start building out an interface.
I think of it kind of like when you're writing a script for a play or a movie, right? You actually would dialogue, you know, think of like the monospaced font where you've got speaker one, or in this case, it'd be, you know, Alexa or Google or whoever, right? Agent and user, and they, you know, get like bolded print what they're going to say. And that just goes back and forth, and you can see linearly a way through the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it gets you thinking about other things as well. Like, you know, if we want to use the correct terminology, it might be like slots or variables, but, or entities. But I think as you're scripting, you kind of, it's hard to think about these things without actually, you know, getting something down on paper. And so I think the, you know, and there's a reason why Amazon and Google, you know, really push, hey, start with the script. And I think it's just because it puts you in the right mental model to build a good voice interface.
Certainly. And I think in addition to that, you see with the script where those slots and things can actually be applied and put in. So you can like circle those things and you can mark up a script. It's not just the text, but then you can use that to highlight things throughout the flow. And important piece as well is to read it out loud and hear it, because if you're just writing, you're not going to experience it the same way that a user does. So a lot of times actually playing it out, role playing it, is really powerful way of wrapping your mind around exactly what's happening in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's some people in industry can call that Wizard of Oz testing. So it's something that comes up quite frequently on our call. And yeah, and just one last note on that. I think it's one thing that's great about scripting is it's such a low barrier to entry. So, you know, it really doesn't matter who you are, the tools you know, the technical expertise you have, everyone can write a script. So I think, you know, if you're looking to build a voice interface, you know, a script is never a bad place to start.
Awesome. And then we talked about flowcharts as well. So flowcharts being, I have, here's my starting point, and then draw a line to this box where I'm going to do this and so forth. Mm-hmm. How does it work exactly? And I guess there's lots of ways of building a flowchart, but what's the basic flow, pun intended, I guess, of going through that process?
Right. So I think it's important to kind of predicate this with flowcharts and voice design often get a really, really bad rap. And I don't completely disagree. I think if, you know, if you're thinking of kind of just a linear branching dialogue, you're in the wrong place. But at the same time, a flowchart can be really valuable to just kind of give a high level idea of, you know, what and where your conversation is going to go and the potential different permutations of, you know, what that can look like. So what we see a lot in the professional use case is we'll have a flowchart, you know, have a very clear start, and then essentially you'll have solid lines, and in the middle will be some form of, you know, written out logic. And so, you know, duplicate this a bunch of times, typically lines going everywhere, and you have some high level idea of, you know, how this thing is going to look when it's built.
Yeah, and I think especially in scenarios like games, for example, or you're building a game engine or something with voice as the interface. And so having a very strict flow through that game may be essential, or you're in an ordering path where you need certain pieces of information to actually accomplish that. It can be good to identify all of those things as long as you're aware that the specific order of things may not always be the way that it's designed in the flowchart.
Yes, exactly. So we talked about the mental model when scripting. The mental model with a flow chart is what is should really be looked at as negative. Because when we think about a flow chart, we think about, you know, we're going down this path and there's no return, there's no exit. It's just, it's this path and it's always going to be this path. And you may have a choice, but you are kind of you're a passenger in this journey. And so if you take that model, then yes, you're thinking about this wrong. But if we just think of a flowchart more as, you know, a guide or the happy path in which a user could take, then I don't really see a problem there. So I think this kind of segues interestingly into, a conversation I had, with Paul Kutzinger at, Alexa, where he outlined kind of the three types of voice interactions that we see today. And so the first one is like super transactional. So, you know, going back to that PayPal example, you know, what is my bank balance? It's input and then it's an output. And so then the second one is, you know, assistant driven conversations. So that would be, as you just mentioned, you know, your quiz games, your interactive stories, things like that, where the user is taking, you know, the user understands that they are a passenger. And that, you know, things are going to happen and, you know, that's just how it's going to go. And then the last one, is, you know, those user driven experiences. So that, is, you know, trying to mimic, or create natural conversation. And so I think right now, you know, almost everyone is building for one, the number one or number two. And so with that in mind, you know, flowcharts for those use cases really do make a ton of sense. And in many ways can be the best way to actually quickly, you know, get something to market, especially in an exploratory phase of, you know, voice, at least from the consumer's end. And so then the last one, that number three, those user-driven experiences, that's where, you know, as a creative community and as a company at VoiceFlow, we really think about, hey, you know, if that third, if those user-driven experiences are what the future is, then, you know, how do we unlock that for designers? How do we build tooling, you know, that allows people to create those non-linear conversations, you know, in the best way possible. So that's really the, you know, the question.
And, yeah. And with the user-driven experiences, this is a new space that I want to get to talk about the future in just a moment. So maybe we can circle back to that in just a few minutes. Let's focus back on situational design for a moment and outline it just a little bit further. So this is another type of design tactic that I think Paul might be the
spearhead.
Yeah, the evangelist of this, I think. And it's generally trying to think in the moment, not so much about a flow, but thinking about based on what I just have and what I know about the past, what situation am I in now and what I do about it. So can you give a little bit more information about situational design for folks who might not have heard this term?
Yeah. So I'll hop in here. So situational design is sort of a new skin on an older topic. So state-based design. And so state-based design is, you can imagine you have a bunch of different things that you need to fulfill a particular intent. So let's say, for example, you want to order a Starbucks coffee. You may need the size. You might need the location you want to order from and the type of coffee. So you need three different things. You know, there might be outside parameters as well. You know, is this your first session with the voice app? You know, what time of day is it? Is the store open? Those sorts of things as well. And essentially, the combination of all of those different states would produce a different response. And so it's not like a flowchart where you go down and you essentially go, if this is true, then go down this path. And if this is true, go down this path. You're doing it in what Paul and the Amazon team are calling storyboards to do this whole situational design, where you're going to design the variety of situations based off different combinations of state. If we don't have location, but we have this and this, then say this, et cetera, et cetera. And that will create a whole array of these different cards. And so this has actually been done for a little while now, especially in the IVR space. And what they were using before is spreadsheets. And so this new storyboard approach is just a more intuitive and more well-designed system to replace what was predominantly being done on spreadsheets before.
Oh, fascinating. When you say state-based design, like state is a more of a concept for programming. It's this mm-hmm. idea of a machine has a certain state, right? It's on or it's off. That's the state. And in designers, I don't know if that's a vocabulary that they're as familiar with. So if I could push you a little bit harder on the state-based concept, how could you break that down a little bit further for folks who might not be familiar with this concept?
Sure. Yeah. I think, like, let's look at a really simple interaction that, you know, a user could have with a voice assistant. So let's say user needs to change the temperature. So let's say they go, you know, Alexa, change the temperature to 74. I gave this utterance or this intent to the agent. However, there's essentially infinite permutations of my state. So, you know, I could be a first-time user, as Braden said. The temperature could already be 75 degrees. You know, I could be engaging as myself. You know, maybe that is you know, different if you know, someone else in the home is engaging with that, you know, with that utterance. And so it's really thinking about, hey, you know, this is in visual design, we dictate the state as designers, right? I hit the landing page and I already have a subset of buttons and, you know, I have a call to action and it's very clear, you know, I am setting the state of my user. In voice design, you have to flip the script, and the you know, the user, their current state should dictate you know, what happens next. So I think that shift in kind of design approach you know, might be challenging, and you know, it definitely was challenging for myself coming from, you know, a UI UX background. But it really is the key to unlock true, you know, human-like conversation. Is really understanding the state, taking the time to understand all the potential states that a user could be in, and then designing responses and experiences for, you know, for the most important ones.
And just for a little added clarity here, every time we say state, we mean synonymously with situations. A situation is simply a different combination of state. You could have the size, you could not have the location, you could have this, therefore that means it's this situation. That's what we mean by that.
And, you know, Google calls it context. Mm-hmm. Amazon calls it situation. The developer would call it states. So yeah, all those things. Like that. We'll just, you know, it's back to the skills, actions, capsules issue.
Yeah, it's certainly a recurring theme in the voice space that there's a lot of terms for the same thing.
Yeah, and that's thank you. That was a really good breaking down of that. Like, you know, and state changes over time, right? If I'm in a car or I'm in my house and someone asks me where I'm going, I'm going to probably handle that very differently, but it's the same question. And being able to be human about that and recognizing where I'm at, you know, location information or what device I'm talking to, all that adds to that state, as well as what have I done in the past? And if I've recently been talking about if I've been talking about Abraham Lincoln, and then I ask questions about when he was president, you know, that's also state that would be carried through the conversation to know that I'm talking about this person instead of you having to say, who are you talking about? And so it brings continuity to the experience, which is why it's so important. And it's flowcharts and things can lose that if you think that state always comes through a certain path, which is, I think, where you said we have to be careful about flowcharts, and they do get a bad rap, and they can provide a lot of things, but they also make it difficult for people who are looking at them and trying to figure out the flow of things. If they code to that flow or build the experience based on what they see there, they might miss the grander picture here of all these permutations of situation or state or context. And then we're left with this flow where you're forced out. I tried out an app that was like a mortgage calculator, and it simply said, what's the mortgage amount? And then it would only accept an answer. I couldn't like go back and edit a previous question or do anything other than that. I couldn't even leave the app. It wouldn't like it captured that somehow and forced me to answer a numeric value. And I was like, this is an example of how the flowchart got the experience wrong.
A well-built flowchart. So the great thing about flowcharts is it is the most powerful way to design. And the thing is, we sort of take shortcuts. If you can do state-based design using flowcharts if you have logic. So for example, if this state is this, then go down this path, and you can actually do it. But the problem with flowcharts is that there are just so many permutations of situation and state that it actually becomes such an unruly tree that people don't think it's possible with flowcharts, but it is. However, it's just completely impractical.
Yeah, exactly. There's a point at which the reasoning breaks down, and you look at this, it becomes it's like that in the airline magazine where they show you all of the places you can fly, and there's so many lines on the map that you can't tell where any of the lines actually go, but you can see the end points that they're going to. It's like you lose the path between the two. So same thing here. I think flowcharts, I use them. I generally say you need probably two things. You need to at least do two types of design and codifying your design to make it sensible to everybody, because some things will make sense to some people and not to others. And also, it just gives you a wider view of that thing that you're building if you script it and storyboard it, or you know, you actually use flowcharts and scripting as well. Whatever the case is, two things will broaden and multiply that vision much more clearly than just relying only on one.
Yeah, and you know, that's what we see people doing. So you know, when we're talking to users, when we're talking to, you know, UI designers, you know, building some pretty prominent experiences, and really being the first people at these, you know, companies or agencies thinking about this, they're doing both. You know, they have their flowchart, you know, using a number of tools, and they have their spreadsheet, which is, you know, kind of acting as that state machine. Mm-hmm. And so what they use the flowchart for is, you know, communicating with external stakeholders on, you know, this is how this is going to work, you know, communicating with their internal team, just, you know, give a really easy visual representation of what's happening. And then at the same time, they need to communicate with their development team. And so, you know, that's where the Excel sheet comes in. So, you know, yeah, we see people deploying both these strategies at the same time.
So there's a few, obviously, like VoiceFlow, and there's other software being built today that's relatively new. And these are platforms that are building out conversational design experiences that are more along the situational design path, but what are these different software platforms like, and how does this lead us towards the future of designing for voice?
Yeah, you know, the way we typically look at other platforms and you know, sort of the competitive landscape in general is the more the merrier, because I don't think anyone's figured it out. So, you know, there are probably less than 10,000 professional VUI designers out there right now. And so as a, you know, a space, as an industry, it's really important that we have as many people trying to train others, trying to embed best practices, and trying to figure out, you know, what is it that, you know, what does a good conversational design software look like, and how can we, you know, promote the existence of more of them. I don't think there's necessarily any one platform which is amazing, amazing at everything. I generally think, you know, for example, the GUI platforms that have added voice functionality might be really good at state-based design. There's a lot of flowcharting software out there, like, for example, Visio and Whimsical, and they're obviously good at flowcharts, but then they don't allow you to prototype or test or do state-based design very well. So I think it really depends on what you're trying to do. I think there's a tool for everything at this point. And I, you know, we try to encourage people at Voiceflow to try out as many of them as you can. They're all generally, you know, relatively easy to learn how to use, and find out, you know, what's best for your team, what's best for your workflow, and, you know, what you're trying to do. You know, we serve almost, I think, yeah, over 10,000 designers and developers now. And a lot of them, you know, don't just use Voiceflow. They'll have three or four different tools that, you know, they'll pull out of their toolbox on any given day, depending on the task. And so, you know, that's generally the approach we push right now.
Do you see people, like, what are the skills people are going to need as the software does things like automatically design and prototype in one, like, package? What are the skills that we need either as developers or designers to cultivate, so that as we build more and more complex and move towards that third category of user-driven experiences, what are the skills we need?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, just like any UI UX designer, you know, has a tool of choice, you know, whether they use, you know, Figma or Sketch or Photoshop, you know, or XD or Marvel, you know, the list goes on, really. So, you know, I think understanding, learning a tool is important. At least one, as Brittany just said, you know, there's a myriad of tools out there. I think, you know, playing around with a lot of them is great. On top of that, you know, learn how the tech works. We talk to a lot of people that, you know, are new to the space and, you know, haven't really taken the time to understand the intricacies of, you know, voice, I guess, the underlying tech, if we know, whether that's like intent, slots, entities, you know, understand these things, understand how they actually play into the user experience, so that when you're designing these interfaces, you know, you're not just kind of handing off, you know, what would be synonymous to just a static sketch file. You know, it can be a little more, you can be a little more knowledgeable there, and, you know, help your development team out.
Yeah, certainly the challenge in some of the visual design space has been, you know, using one medium for design and then exporting that to a developer who then has to guess some of the things that are depicted.
I think that's one thing that's really interesting about voice is that, you know, we'll see people, you know, come onto our platform with an idea and very little to no technical expertise. And whether they are in the mindset that they're designing or prototyping or building, you know, they're creating something fully functional. So I think, you know, in the visual space, someone that did that really well was Webflow. So, you know, they kind of packaged the power of front-end web development, at least from a landing page perspective, into, you know, a tool that gave designers the ability to actually not just design, but to prototype and to build, you know, as they're designing. And I think that voice in many respects offers that, you know, at least some degree of that same thing. When you are writing the scripts, when you are writing out the intents, the slots, you know, when you're writing out your prompts and responses, to some level, you are developing, you know, this voice interface. Sure, you might need a developer to come in and, you know, add the fulfillment and codify the situations. But I don't think their voice needs to be one of those spaces where there's a massive gap between design and development. I actually think the opposite, and that it can be quite tightly knit.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that, where it has to be tighter together because we control a little bit less of the surface area. Like we may have our guardrails and what we can do in voice, but versus a website or something you can visually force people to click on certain buttons or to see certain pages, we're at the will of the user in many cases. And so we have to be much more tightly integrated with how design and development work together, because they have to understand users at a deeper level than I would argue traditional web design does in most cases. And that's a factor of the medium, as well as how things have evolved over the last 23 years or however long the internet's been around now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, in just from a really practical standpoint, if we look at, let's just use, you know, Alexa skills as a proxy. If we go on the Alexa store and look at, you know, the, you know, 80,000, I think it's getting close to 100,000 now, skills that have, you know, been built. You know, these aren't things, a lot of them aren't very useful, and a lot of people actually don't like them. And the reason being, to some extent, now I'm not pinning this fully on developers, but, you know, these are built by developers. You know, design for voice is, you know, kind of a new idea. It's something that, you know, people haven't fully grasped yet. And that's what makes it really exciting. And that's why, you know, we see a bunch of software companies trying to provide solutions, or, you know, at the very least, talking to people in the space, understanding their workflow. Because these are problems that you know, aren't solved, and I would retort anyone that says that they've solved it, including ourselves. So yeah.
What's interesting about the voice space is, as Mike was alluding to, it's you don't know what a good voice design is until you actually have a human talk to it. When you're designing a GUI, you know, a graphic interface, designers who have a good eye for design can typically tell what a good design looks like. Yeah, you know, the button should be here. That looks great. And you can typically ship something without having to go through an insane amount of you know, iterations on the visual design. But in voice, you know, you can only imagine how, you know, you would speak when you're scripting. You're coming from your own biases of how you talk and how you communicate with other people. And so, you know, user testing and prototyping becomes such a huge component. I would argue more so than in graphic interfaces, because you actually have to anticipate how other people talk, and you just cannot do that without actually, you know, putting it in front of them. So, you know, we see user testing and prototyping as an enlarged part of the design process now. To the point where we have companies come on where they already have a script, and all they want to do is, you know, slap together a really quick prototype on VoiceFlow before they get to building, because, you know, that's what you need to do to actually design something that's fantastic. You need to prototype it first.
Yeah. And just to add on there, like, you know, we are in this, you know, this phrase is used a lot, but, you know, we're the first batter of the, you know, the first inning of, you know, voice and voice design. So I think that the luxury that, you know, UI and UX design have is that people have solved a lot of the really hard design problems. And that wasn't one company that did it. You know, one company didn't say, hey, you know, we're going to put a static nav bar on the bottom. You know, it was the creative community that, you know, tried different things, found out what worked, found out what didn't. And then in doing that, you know, now every app you open up typically, you know, is laid out somewhat similarly. And so, you know, we haven't found those design trends in voice yet. And, you know, it might be a little harder, given that people can't see it. But I think that that's going to be something that's really important, regardless of the tooling you have.
Yeah. Just to add on to Mike's point there, there's a lot of great case studies and sort of articles on when the web first came out. The first websites looked like brochures, because that was the medium before. And so that's what we understood. And then when the first mobile apps came out, a lot of them were designed like websites because that's the medium before it and that's what we knew. And so now you're having a lot of these voice apps which are being treated almost like mobile in that it's walking you through the menu of, hi there, here's the three things we can do, you know, akin to the three buttons on your mobile app. And then, you know, the user selects it, you know, that's like tapping it. Okay, now here's, you know, the next set of options. It's very similar to like a mobile interface if you were to turn, you know, this GUI into a VUI. And so I just think we haven't found what a good voice user interface looks like. And I think we're, you know, a heck of a lot closer than we were 5 or 10 years ago, but we're certainly not there yet. And, you know, I was chatting with a UX person at General Assembly today and they said, you know, the tools shape the way you think. And it's totally true. I think as the tooling evolves, it'll help evolve how we think. And, you know, hopefully we'll get to the point where people are, you know, going voice first.
This has been really, really good. I appreciate you guys joining me today. And we need to round it off here with the end of the show, which I like to call the endpoint detection. But to begin that section, let's circle back and recap. What's the top takeaway that you have for today?
So I think, you know, a lot of what we talked about is understanding the different types of tactics we can use when, you know, looking to design a voice interface. But, you know, what assembly of those tactics is the right one is something that is, you know, is not solidified. And so I think, you know, to wrap that up into one sentence is, you know, in order to find that solution, I think that, you know, we just need to get more people building voice interfaces and see what happens.
All right. What's one interesting voice experience that you've had recently?
Okay, interesting. So I just got my AirPods the other day. So I was excited to see kind of what those could do. So just this morning, I ordered an Uber to the office. And when I was, what was I doing? I was getting ready or something out of my AirPods and I was listening to music. I invoked, you know, Siri and said, you know, how far away, is my Uber? And it did nothing. So like that was, you know, interestingly bad, not positive. But you know, I think that's a, you know, an example of, you know, where there needs to be some designer there thinking about the situations that a user is in and building for those. And then I think another one that's really interesting, although I haven't used it, is McDonald's. So I use this app every day in Toronto called Ritual, where you order food before time, you pay, you know, a tiny premium, and then you just go pick it up rather than waiting in those long lunch lines. And so I've thought for a long time, like, hey, you know, all these voice activated cars are gonna, you know, have Alexa and Google Assistant. You know, is the drive-through going to get automated away into a more, I order it and pick it up. And so lo and behold, McDonald's, you know, announced last week that they're I guess, piloting that experience in some locations in Chicago.
A couple weeks ago, I was walking down Spadina, which is a big street in Toronto. And I was just with a friend and I saw this young group of girls beside us. And one of the girls pulled out her phone and actually invoked Alexa to ask for help, which is funny because that's one of the things that, you know, we talk about, you know, voice is going to be everywhere. You know, people are going to be using voice for everything. But it's not something that you generally see every day yet. It's more so of a conceptual statement. So to actually see someone go voice first, in the middle of the street, you know, there was no reason for them to use Alexa over any other medium, but they still chose to, you know, bring out their phone and use Alexa. That was really cool. And you know, that was a big moment. And, I think the next one for us is going to be when I see someone purchase something, you know, they do some, voice commerce from the subway. I think that, you know, that'll be the next one for me that, you know, we're moving a lot faster than we think.
Yeah, the future is wide open on a lot of this stuff. And I think you're right. The adoption is starting to show and people are trying to figure out their choices and preferences. And sometimes they'll use it. And I'm curious to see where all this is going to go. What kinds of resources do you recommend for people who want to learn about design?
Yeah, I think it does depend on what you're building in the context of Alexa skills and Google Actions. I think the platforms themselves have a lot of really good resources. that can get you in the right state of mind and you know, get you up to speed quickly. So I think it's either Alexa.design or design.alexa, and kind of Google kind of has a counterpart to that, where, you know, the messaging is a little different. There's a lot of overlap. But yeah, I think those are definitely good places to start.
Excellent. And finally, how can people learn more about you and your work and your company?
Yeah, they can go to voiceflow.com and you can sign up for free and, you know, get started, hopefully implementing some of the practices we were chatting about today. Other than that, I think we're on Twitter as well at VoiceflowHQ. I'm personally there as Reem Braden. I think, Mike, what's your handle?
Oh, I don't even know. Mikey_Hood. I signed up a few days ago for Braden's request.
Yeah, so. Everyone give Mike a follow, please.
I think I have 6 followers, so that's fun.
Let's make it, let's double that.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's aim for 12.
All right. Well, okay. This was a great episode. I really appreciate all of your thoughts and sharing these different design tactics and processes. I think experienced designers will be familiar with these things, but I still think there's good stuff in for them as they're trying to compare and understand where things are going and what kinds of things they might need to be leveling up on in their skills. I think especially in the space of testing and prototyping and understanding the core technologies under the hood, because those are going to dictate what the designs can actually promise and fulfill.
I'll tell you, one of the most interesting things I've noticed just from talking to a ton of professional VUI designers is there's sort of like a parabola effect on flowcharts, in that people start like an upside down parabola. So people start loving flowcharts. Like when you first get into VUI design, it's your favorite thing. In the middle, so you have intermediate, sort of novices. As they start to hear about situational design, they start to say, oh, flowcharts are the worst. And then, you know, we've talked to some of the world's best VUI designers now, and, you know, people who teach this, you know, they teach human-computer interaction courses at prestigious universities, and they go, no, flowcharts are great. And so you sort of go through this middle period of disliking them, I think, because you're supposed to dislike them. But at the end of the day, you know, there's nothing better at the moment, as long as the software enables the flowchart to hop around and have context and things like that. Yeah, just a little fun little tidbit at the end.
Yeah, great. And it's so true. All of these things are going to be useful, and some of them might be more useful in certain cases than others. But your awareness of these different things, scripting, situational design, storyboarding, flowcharts, will make you a better designer or developer even. And using those things, especially if you pair them up, will hopefully unlock additional opportunities that you could build with your voice skills. So once again, thank you for joining me today. And it's been a great time. We'll make sure all the links and things are on the website. So just want to thank you one more time, both Braden and Mike.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Thanks.
It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It was great.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. And if you liked the show, please rate us on your favorite podcast player. All of the show notes are available on designforvoice.com.